This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The problems surrounding homelessness haven't gone away, so we're bringing back our conversation with Marcus Martin with Grace Beyond Borders, Northwest Indiana, a nonprofit charitable public organization with a mission to combat homelessness in the region. Marcus, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me here, and I appreciate this opportunity to share just some of the things that's going on in Northwest Indiana that a lot of people are not aware of.
Well, take a moment, if you will, first just briefly describe what Grace Beyond Borders Northwest Indiana is all about.
A 501c nonprofit organization, and we had our this initiation in 2013, in which we began to, for over these last 6 years, rescue homeless women, children, and men out of deplorable, unsafe, unsanitary conditions by offering them a hand up, not a handout.
How serious is the problem of homelessness here in Northwest Indiana?
See, we spend a lot of time on the streets making connections with homeless individuals and with citizens who are very much aware of what's really going on with homelessness. And we uncovered just huge problem that was being ignored or not, people were not aware of what's really going on by the number of homelessness that we encountered. It's been a tsunami of homeless women with children who are seeking emergency help, and it's just not there. In East Chicago, there is not any type of emergency shelter or transitional housing for individuals who are homeless.
I know that you have described in one media account that the homeless are our invisible neighbor. And explain, if you will, please, why you feel that way.
Yes, they are neighbors because, one, they're part of our community, and they are often hidden for two reasons. One, people ignore them. They tend not to look or make eye contact with individuals who they deem may be homeless, or the second thing is a lot of people who are homeless are embarrassed and ashamed of their situation, not ever planning to be homeless. And something happened in their life where unemployment, domestic violence, medical hardship propelled them into homelessness. So because of the embarrassment and shame, they just do not want to be identified as being homeless. Oftentimes, they're right in our company, and because they don't look homeless, we think they don't exist. So they're invisible.
I know we've heard accounts of going to young people who are homeless, family members who are homeless, and youngsters going to school, and it seems, at least to everybody around them, particularly at school, that there's nothing wrong, except that there's really is something wrong, that maybe the young person relies on the meals he gets or she gets at school because there is no place at home to be able to have a regular meal, and then staying at home basically means staying in a shelter.
Well, when you are a school-age child, you have the school as a place to not only get a meal but also to wash up, especially if you're in a situation which we have been alerted of, as individuals who are sleeping in their vehicles with their children, adults who don't have any other place to of any type of refuge or shelter. So you have to wash up. You have to maintain your cleanliness, or otherwise you can get teased or bullied. So school could be arriving at school very early, leaving late, opportunities where a person can actually wash up. You got your fast food restaurants. People tend to wash up. They go inside one of the stalls, lock the door, and they're able to change clothes and wash up. See, these things are going on under our nose, and many people just don't pay attention, or we don't care, or we're not concerned. But as a college student, a mom whose husband had his hands around her neck trying to choke her to death in front of her four-year-old, so she chose to be homeless to escape that situation and could not find any shelter. So she got her daughter into a safe place, and she had her personal vehicle, so she would park at night in the garage of one of the local hospitals, where there's lighting and a sense of safety there. And that's the kind of, you have to be creative. You have to sleep somewhere at night. And it can be very uncomfortable being on the streets exposed to whatever situations may be out there.
I know there's one example that you give about these places where I guess what you could say the not so hidden homeless are staying in abandoned buildings. They're not vacant because it's where a lot of homeless people stay. You describe us what one of these homes that has been occupied on Elm Street looks like. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a two-story house, and some homeless individuals were able to gain access to the house through the window of the basement or through the back window near the porch area. And so you figure they are out of the elements, and they have they had a number of different rooms there. It was, I believe, a two-bedroom house, downstairs and upstairs. Mm-hmm. So you have a number of people can stay in there. Then you had the bedrooms had doors, so you can have a number of individuals, even couples, who are staying in that type of setting. And these individuals that pretty much know each other, and from time to time, they are able to gather together and say, hey, we have a place here. There's no light. There isn't any light at night, and there's not any running water or heat, so there's no utilities, but it's a place where they can lie down at night, close their eyes, because there's simply not anything else available. And we want to turn that around to reach the individuals who have a heart, who, if they know about this situation, will not allow individuals to sleep in those type of settings, that would respond and give a small donation. Just skip a meal, one meal out the month, and just one meal, which could be a $5, fast food or restaurant meal, and donate that to Grace Beyond Border.
We're talking with Marcus Martin, executive director and founder of an organization called Grace Beyond Borders. They're located in East Chicago, and I understand this is really a kind of an outgrowth of what you had done as a volunteer for a church in Chicago, the Apostolic Church of God. They've been very involved, I guess, on volunteer level for some time with the homeless, and certainly in the Chicago area. And you find it's the same problem everywhere, apparently.
You know, it was a real eye-opener for me when I started back in 2001 with our homeless outreach ministry in Chicago. I mean, it's a good example. See people on the streets but not realizing how many people are actually homeless unless you're at a homeless shelter there. And then you see the number of people going in there. I just had no idea. And then when I looked at Indiana, it's different. You're not seeing people who are camped out, in certain areas. You don't see tents and you don't see mattresses and things. But we had to, as we worked over the last 6 years, we began to ask a question, where are you sleeping? And that's when we started identifying the different multiple locations individuals have slept.
Do you find in talking with folks, regardless whether it's in Chicago or here in Northwest Indiana, that with the problem of homelessness being so pervasive all over, not only our region, but all over the country, that the efforts to help support these people are pretty much the same, that if you're offering hope and love and care as well for all these folks and for food and clothing and lodging for those that need it the most, that it seems to give them hope and in turn will maybe possibly help turn some of their lives around?
Well, let me give you an example. Back in 2015, I met a woman during my outreach on the streets, which we did a lot of. That's where the contact is made, on the streets. And this young woman would participate in what we call our Celebrate Recovery program. And she had a heroin addiction, and also was in an abusive relationship. And off and on, she would come and, be involved with our program, and we just poured the love of God all over her, and then she disappeared. But back in September, she came in, and she had hit bottom. She said she was tired and she wanted, she knew what she needed to do, and we encouraged her, and she is doing this super great right now. She just finished up a 60-day initial recovery program, treatment program in South Bend, where we assisted her with transportation to get there. And then also she is enrolled in a long-term recovery program, and that's critical.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it takes, and she is just so determined, and she communicates with me every week, and you know, two or three times out the week, she's all over my Facebook page with words of encouragement. But that's an example. When you give a person an opportunity and you open up the door and you deal with a total person, mind, body, spirit, then you give them a chance. You give them hope to move out of their situation, because that woman also had a story of this adverse childhood experience of rape during her, you know, by a relative.
Right.
So, and abuse, you know, constant. So rising over all that requires just not just a place for them to lay their head down, to lie down, but a place where they can begin to heal. They can, you know, things in their life can be restored, and they can actually get hope to move to the next level. And that's what we do.
It's interesting that you should mention about helping find places for homeless people to stay on a long-term basis, in particular the fact that you're even arranging transportation. Are you finding that the opportunities for homeless shelter options don't happen to be around our area, that you do sometimes have to take somebody to a faraway city to be able to get them to stay in someplace comfortable and more secure?
Most definitely. You have to have places have to have that type of staffing and type of service available. We deal mainly with my mentors, which is the rescue mission in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Also, we've had success with Wheeler Rescue Mission in Indianapolis, and on the Illinois side, Aurora Wayside Mission, because they all offer long-term, and that's critical. It takes time for people to heal and to be restored from just some of the traumas in their lives. They just can't get a quick 8-week fix and put back out on the streets and say, okay, we gave you 8 weeks, next. It has to be where they have some time in which they can grow, which they can, you know, overcome some of the hardships in their life that weren't supposed to be there. And we do have significant support. We do have to grow some more support. Again, we're reaching out to 8,000 people, just skipping one restaurant meal each month and donating that $5, and just donate that to what we're doing, and we will have those operational dollars that we need, and we can move on. Now we do have a place where they can donate, www.thefaceofgrace. They can't forget the T-H-E, thefaceofgrace.org, and there's opportunity to donate there also. They can send their, and we do receive checks and money orders at our Grace Beyond Borders post office box, 927 East Chicago, Indiana, 46312.
Marcus, thank you very much for spending some time to talk with us. The efforts that Grace Beyond Borders is doing in East Chicago and all of Northwest Indiana in particular, even branching as far away as South Bend as need be to help find homeless residents a place to stay that they feel safe and warm and comfortable in. We appreciate you spending time, Marcus, to talk with us today about it.
Okay.
Marcus Martin is the executive director of an organization called Grace Beyond Borders. It's based in East Chicago, and they're doing their best to help find homes for homeless people in Northwest Indiana. This is Ridgely speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, you have your W-2 forms, any other forms you may need to be able to prepare yourself for the income tax returns you're going to have to file here before too long. Well, how do you better prepare for tax season? That's why we turn now to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer to take a look at the issues and the things that have changed dramatically with the changes in the tax laws. Greg, as always, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start out first here talking about the gathering of all, having all your ducks in a row, so to speak here. It's very important to have all the documents that you think you're going to need either on hand if you're going to do it yourself, you're going to use any kind of automated software, or you're going to turn it over to your financial advisor.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, this year a lot of people are going to realize that some of the information in the past that was relevant won't be relevant, but it could be relevant in, different planning opportunities. But we always tell people W-2s are the obvious, but make sure there's things that you didn't do during the year that maybe were different with the distribution, or maybe open a different account that could have generated another 1099. And we always warn people with brokerage accounts, make sure that it's a final brokerage account, because a lot of times they'll get one out there because of the deadline and end up issuing a revised one.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the paperwork that you need, you talk about 1099s in particular, what's out there that you need to be aware of that you may have to take advantage of?
Well, a lot of people may have started a different type of savings account. Maybe it could be as simple as a CD at a bank where there's an interest statement coming. And, the past few years, as you know, that never really related to a large amount, but interest rates have risen. So those statements that you may not have been getting before, money sitting in, money market accounts or CDs that you converted, might actually generate 1099s where in the past they didn't. And then, again, there's some things unique to if you moved money, rolled one over to, one qualified plan to another. While they don't often impact the tax return, they should be reported on the tax return.
And probably Social Security paperwork, too, is probably important as well if you haven't gotten already. Of course, it may be delayed, too, because of the partial government shutdown.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people just that have gotten in the past are familiar with what they get in the past. So you just got to be cognizant that you got everything. I always tell people it's fine to go in and begin the tax process early if you like to get it done quickly, but just make sure that it matches up. If you haven't used that previous tax preparer, or if you're thinking about doing it on your own, to make sure that it's matching up with everything that you had the previous year. That's usually a pretty good checks and balances.
One thing we know, too, that there are some new tax forms that we have to deal with these days. Tell us about that and what kind of impact that the average taxpayer and tax return filer will have to know about.
Well, and, the strange thing about it, Chris, is they're not even all out yet. So, as preparers ourselves, we're still waiting to look at some of them and see some of the new ones. But, yeah, it's going to be an entirely different format. They're trying to simplify the actual 1040 because of the way they're structuring the standard deduction now. So there will be some new looks and some things to get familiar with. And that could bring value to using a preparer still to make sure that you're not missing anything because of the simplification on the forms.
Mm-hmm. Also, too, I guess we've kind of talked about the fact that many people, of course, take advantage of the new automated ways to be able to put your tax return together and to file it with the state and the federal governments. But I guess the question comes down to whether you're going to do it yourself or whether you're going to turn it over to somebody else.
Absolutely. And there are times where we'll mention to somebody, hey, this is something you might want to do just online. It's simple. The thing to be just aware of, I think most people realize there's nothing free. So all free softwares, they give you the software, but then there's generally a cost associated with filing your physical return online so that it's common sense, right? So if you want to be cost effective, just make sure you're aware of those do-it-yourselves and what type of total cost it would take not only just to get the software, but to actually go ahead and complete. And in that area, we always tell people, there's two things, the taxes, preparation and planning. If you're just looking to prepare your taxes, a lot of times those softwares are going to be very, very effective and you're prepping your taxes. But if you're looking to see, hey, am I missing some things? Is there some things I'm not thinking? Is there ways that I could potentially change the input instead of just putting it in and finding out the result? That's where planning becomes involved, and that's where, the value of a tax professional could be added.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer here about some of the changes and things to be aware of here with the changes in the new tax laws and all. One point in particular I know is, and we bring it up here occasionally, and this time of year especially, is the importance of the W-4 and making sure that it's correct. Tell us about that.
Well, I think the biggest thing with the W-4 that people got to realize, the government wanted these monies to be put into the economy throughout the year last year. So there was a lot of adjustments made on withholdings relative to the new tax laws. So one of the things that, you know, might come as quite of a surprise to a lot of folks, and, you know, we were proactive with a lot of our clients in that looking at these withholdings, they changed them. You know, so what you were used to or what you were accustomed to getting, either in the refund or what you were familiar with, what you need to cover for a tax obligation to break even, could have changed. And the new laws don't necessarily equate to lower taxes for everybody. And a lot of folks that were using their returns for savings to pay, you know, property taxes, as an example, to pay for a college tuition, you know, they tweaked those W-4 holdings to the new laws in most organizations. So a lot of those benefits would have been changed to a way where, you know, somebody that was normally expecting a larger refund to pay for something that they had earmarked through that refund may be surprised. And that's where you need to go and, you know, revisit the W-4, what the withholdings are, and adjust them back to where, you know, you were comfortable in the past.
Okay. And finally here, let's take a look here. We know we get the returns done, but sometimes there are things that get in the way of making sure that that return is completely completed and ready to file. If not already filed, you may have to do an extension. Tell us about the situation now with the changes about filing an extension if necessary.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very useful tool, as I tell individuals. Filing the extension can give you that extra opportunity. The one thing we always mention to folks, whether you're in the new law or the old law, filing an extension doesn't file the deadline for your tax obligation.
Right.
So if you do owe money, you know, you want to make sure you have a pretty accurate idea and pay that as a prepayment by the April deadline. But if you don't have anything, you're not sure, it's just prudent to say, you know what, let me file an extension, get as close as I can to my estimate so that I'm not waiting on documents. A lot of times, the brokerage statements, they'll indicate that they're going to send a revised form, a lot of trusts, K-1 schedules, things that normally don't come out to mid-March where you're getting them at the end of March, could be things that you're just not sure if you have everything yet. So be willing and able to file an extension. Just make sure that you're covering your tax obligation, you know, as you come into that deadline.
Now, will the State Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service accept pretty much if you do the best you can and come as close in your estimate to what you actually may owe and send that in? Will that at least be able to, in the meantime, give you an opportunity to get your extension done and then make up the balance or whatever you have?
So, unfortunately, they're not as forgiving past the April 15th deadline. What they are more forgiving on is if you put in enough tax obligation or withholdings based on what your previous tax experience was, there's a safe harbor.
Yeah.
But as you begin to get into things that you know occurred during the year, if you're not pretty close in guessing that, you know, because you can estimate those things in a return, if you get to substantial amounts, the deadline is April 15th. So they can tag interest and penalties on those obligations. So, you know, often it's more err the side of caution, pay more than what you think, and then when you file your extension, you get a refund and you eliminate the potential for those penalties and interest charges.
Awesome. Very interesting and important things to know as we all get ready for getting the returns, whether it's a state or a federal income tax return together. And as always, we thank you very much, Greg, for giving us the latest information, and we'll check back here as we get a little closer to that April 15th deadline, because I'm sure there'll be some more changes we'll probably have to talk about.
Well, thanks, Chris. I appreciate the time.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. We check in with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch from time to time to find out what is happening at the State House. In particular, it's very important now that we have the General Assembly back in session. We covered some of her comments here just before the session began, and we have Lieutenant Governor Crouch back with us. Welcome back to Regionally Speaking.
Well, it's good to be back, Chris. Thank you.
Well, let's start in here on a topic before we get to the lawmakers, another topic involving another T, tourism. And I understand that you have a new director of the Indiana Office of Tourism Development. Tell us about her, where she comes from, and her experience that she's going to take into working from southern Indiana now into the center of the state and all across Indiana.
Misty Weisensteiner is no newcomer to tourism. She actually was the former executive director of the Orange County Economic Development Partnership. And prior to that, she was the former Visit French Lick West Baden executive director. So she started out as director of brand, marketing, and sales. And what is so interesting about Misty is we conducted a national search and received over 100 applicants for our tourism director, our executive director. And Misty just rose to the top all the time. And so we're really excited about her knowing Indiana, experiencing Indiana, promoting Indiana, and then being from Indiana, coming into that new state tourism director position. We know that she knows the story and is a big advocate and promoter of Indiana, and is going to do a great job at the state level.
Now, how is she going to be able to fit in with the Tourism Task Force report that just came out here last month?
Well, the Tourism Task Force report came about from meetings throughout 2018 to look at the structure and the funding organization of all the states, compare it to Indiana, and then come up with recommendations on how we can take tourism to the next level. What is so interesting is that in Indiana, our tourism is, we have only 1.17% of the share of the U.S. travel market throughout the country. And so we know that we need to be doing things, even though we've done a great job and we keep improving, and our numbers show that, we know that we need an opportunity to really make a change and do things a little differently. So this is an opportunity to really take tourism to the next level. So the Tourism Task Force recommended, and what is actually being proposed in legislation in House Bill 1115, is that the tourism agency become a quasi-government agency, has a board of directors that is comprised of industry and elected officials. It heavily involves the Lieutenant Governor's office as it currently is, but it also needs to partner very closely with the Indiana Economic Development Corporation to be able to tie tourism to economic development. You know, in this day and age, that quality of place and quality of life is so key to individuals that are looking for a place where they want to visit, but then a place that they want to play and stay. And so our ability to tie tourism to quality of place and destination development is only going to further our chances of holding on to talented individuals here in Indiana and attracting new individuals to Indiana. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a new page for tourism, one that we think will benefit not just our state's economy, but local economies, because 72 cents of every tourism dollar that is spent in a community stays in that community. So the more we can grow tourism in Indiana, the more that allows our communities to grow and to prosper, as well as the entire state.
Now, we know that you have the opportunity of being there at the State House to, of course, be in the center of all the action, especially now that the General Assembly is back in session here. And if you being the presiding officer at the Indiana Senate, fill us in, if you will, what the Senate is up to these days, since you're closest to that particular chamber and that body, and how they're fitting all of their work together with what else will be coming forth as the legislature continues on here for the next couple months.
Absolutely. Interestingly, we're at the very beginning of the session, and so currently there are 567 bills that have been filed that actually have been are posted on the Internet. Mm-hmm. Now, we know there can be anywhere from 1,000 to 1,200 actual bills that will be filed, and maybe a little less, but that 1,000 is a number that we always kind of have out there. So we know that there are a lot of bills still to come forward and still to be drafted. And, of course, the Senate released their legislative priorities. And, of course, number one is being able to maintain an honestly balanced budget.
Yeah.
That is most to protect our preserves and to keep taxes low and to allow Hoosiers to keep more money in their paychecks. We also, one of their priorities is protecting our vulnerable children, and not just through attacking and looking at ways to combat the drug epidemic, but by improving our DCS staff and resources that are protecting and caring for our most vulnerable children. You know, supporting education is always key, because over half of the general fund is devoted to K through 12 education. And being able to have that strong commitment to students, teachers, and schools in this upcoming budget session is going to be key. Improving school safety and protecting our schools from the violence that takes vigilance on the part of every Hoosier is going to be extremely important. So they will be looking at including allowing secured school safety grants to be used for mental and behavioral health services. There is a bill that we're supporting, and it creates the commission for the Centennial Women's Suffrage Commission to commemorate the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote, which will occur in 2020. So we're excited about this commission to be able to commemorate and to remember and to celebrate women's right to vote and women's accomplishments over the years. And then, of course, advancing our workforce development. You know, last year we created over 30,000 new jobs here in the state of Indiana, and we are going to probably find out that we've created even more in 2017 and 2018. So our challenge isn't necessarily creating jobs. Our challenge is having the workforce to fill those jobs. So that is going to be a key priority, being able to have many workforce development reforms coming down the pike. So, you know, it's really about making sure that Indiana is serving every Hoosier, but making sure that every Hoosier has the quality of life that they need and they deserve.
I know you keep a close eye not only on the workforce development angle about how Indiana can improve itself and bring more people into the workplace. You keep an eye in general about economic development. I know the Indiana Economic Development Corporation is one of the areas that you work closely with here. And we know just recently they put out some good news about continuing to expand the partnerships that the state of Indiana has, not only with other cities in the United States, but other countries around the world. Tell us about some of the latest developments there.
Well, as you know, we had in March of 2017, we had our first transatlantic nonstop flight from Indianapolis to Paris, and we're looking at dedicating $20 million more to developing more of those transatlantic nonstop flights, because people that are in Indiana and businesses that are looking to come to Indiana know that we are operating in a global economy. So being able to keep them connected throughout the world is absolutely key. We last year, through the Department of Agriculture, and I'm Secretary of Agriculture, mm-hmm. took our first ag trade mission to Manitoba and Winnipeg in Canada. And we have developed a memorandum of understanding to create a stronger bond so that we can learn from their best practices, and they can learn from our best practices. And we will look to continue to do those ag and tourism trade missions in the future. So a lot of ongoing work, a lot of partnerships, a lot of close relationships, because when we all work together, Chris, it results in better government for everyone.
Well, Lieutenant Governor Crouch, a lot of great things have happened, and a lot more things coming up as we have the General Assembly in session. We'll keep an eye on what is coming out from the lawmakers as the next few weeks go on, to be sure. And we appreciate you spending some time with us to give us the update, as well as the latest developments as far as tourism in Indiana is concerned, with the hiring of a new Indiana Office of Tourism Development director, and the experience and the energy that she's going to certainly bring into the job in the months ahead, too. And we thank you for spending time to talk about all this today.
Oh, you're welcome, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
That's Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. For people with disabilities like autism, watching a play with the bright lights and loud noises can be daunting. Now, an Indianapolis theater is changing the way that some shows are staged. Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis has the story.
The Indiana Repertory Theater has performed A Christmas Carol for almost 30 years. But this year's final performance starts differently. The IRT's Director of Education, Randy Pease, takes center stage before the play begins to issue a warning.
Because today's story features ghosts and some frightening elements, we wanted to take a moment to share with you one especially striking sound cue.
That music and a bright light are entrance cues for the Ghost of Christmas Future. But they might be jarring for someone on the autism spectrum who has sensitivity to light and sound. The warning is one of several changes made for audience members with autism. The IRT calls this special show a sensory-friendly performance.
We're just looking forward to seeing families for whom this wouldn't have been an option otherwise to come see it.
That's Sarah Geis, Youth Audience Manager for the theater. This isn't the IRT's first sensory-friendly performance or experience with autism. Last season, it staged The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. The show is about a boy with an autism spectrum disorder. The IRT cast an openly autistic actor, Mickey Rowe, to play the lead role, and it held a special performance geared for people with autism.
After Curious Incident, we went, okay, what can we do for next season? How can we expand this program?
A Christmas Carol was a natural fit. Making a sensory-friendly experience starts before the audience even sees the stage. On the IRT website, guides explain what you'll see from the moment you walk into the theater. And theater programs include a summary and photo of each scene.
And then we break it down sort of from a theatrical term, beat by beat or moment by moment.
Programs also note when there might be a loud sound effect or startling moment. And two staff members seated in front of the stage hold up glow sticks about 10 seconds before these scenes, like the Ghost of Christmas Future entrance cue preview before the show starts. That might seem like a spoiler, but Purdue University's Mandy Rispoli says it could be helpful for people with autism who don't respond well to surprises.
When things are out of the routine, then folks can feel, a little more anxious or uncertain about what's going to happen next, and that can lead to some challenging behaviors or some other sorts of behaviors to try to help them cope with that new environment.
That means the theater, a place of wonder with bustling crowds, swelling music, and brilliant technical displays, can be overwhelming. To make the theater itself friendlier to these guests, the auditorium house lights, dimmed low, stay on for the whole Christmas Carol performance. And there are spaces outside the auditorium where they can watch the show with room to walk or make noise.
If folks need to leave during the performance, they're welcome to at any time, and they're welcome to return at any time.
The changes are made with special needs theatergoers in mind. But the performance isn't limited to people on the autism spectrum. Nor should it be, Rispoli says.
The best thing that families can do is to help get their own kids involved and become involved as well, even if they're not affected by autism or any other disability.
Nikki DeLuga-Gunther is visiting Indianapolis for the holidays. She has been to several sensory-friendly events with her 5-year-old daughter, Zoe. Zoe is not on the autism spectrum, but DeLuga-Gunther says inclusivity is important.
I think it's so important that theater is an opportunity that everyone gets to participate in and see.
What's next for the IRT? Geis hopes the theater can include a sensory-friendly performance each season, allowing more families to develop a new holiday tradition. I'm Lauren Bavis, Side Effects Public Media.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The first female Marine was from northern Indiana. In fact, she was born in Kokomo. She was Opha Mae Johnson. And according to Troy Brownfield, who's a staff writer with the Washington Evening Post, he said that Johnson found herself at the front of the line in 1918 and was the first woman to enlist in the Marines. And she became the first of more than 300 women who would enlist in the Marine Corps during the remainder of World War I. Brownfield spoke with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson recently about the woman pioneer and the article that he wrote featuring her.
You wrote a profile on Opha Mae Johnson, the first
yes.
female Marine who enlisted 100 years ago this August. And she's from Northwest Indiana, right?
That's correct. She was born Opha Mae Jacob in Kokomo in 1879.
So tell us about her.
Opha Mae occupies, a very unique place in history, but there's not a terribly large volume of material written about her. So what we know is that she was born in Kokomo, Indiana. She attended Woods Commercial College, and she was the salutatorian there. And she actually graduated from a department in 1895 that was called the Shorthand and Typewriting Department. So she had these administrative skills and this educational background that was already sort of ahead of its time, considering we're talking about 1895. And then we do know that 3 years later, she married Victor Johnson, and he was the musical director of the Lafayette Square Opera House in Washington, D.C. So that is a little bit of what we know about her prior to the time of her enlistment.
So she helped pave the way for the next generation of female Marines and holds, you said, a lasting legacy in the fight for gender equality in American history. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. The reserve for the United States Marine Corps for women had been established in 1916, which was concurrent with the United States' involvement in World War I at the time. Now, coming down toward the end of the war, during the last 2 years, women were allowed to join the various military branches and reserves, and they were allowed to do that because they were covering responsibilities that men under active deployment had had, but since they had been shipped out, those responsibilities need to be covered by other support staff. So, you know, eventually there would actually be 33,000 women that would serve as support staff across the branches. But, you know, in the case of Johnson, you know, when the announcement came out, you know, on September 1st, or actually it was in August, but the article that covered it was in September 1st, the Richmond Times-Dispatch. In 1918, Johnson went to enlist, and she was the first person. She found herself at the front of the line. And, you know, we often talk about history is written by the people that show up. She happened to show up first. And Private Johnson was the first of over 300 women that enlisted the Marine Corps during the remainder of World War One.
And so what was her service time like? Do you know anything about that? Was it successful?
Yeah. She was sent to Marine Corps headquarters, and she worked as a clerk there. And what she did, ironically enough, was the first assignment she had was managing the records of the other new incoming female Marines. And so she worked there through the conclusion of World War One, so up through November of 1918. Now, at that point, all the branches began discharging the women from active duty because as the men were coming back, they were retaking the old jobs and so forth. But she was still able to work for the government because she took a job based on her experience as a clerk then in the War Department, which it was the forerunner of the Department of Defense. It was renamed Department of Defense in 1949.
Can you tell us about the challenges that she encountered being the first woman Marine?
You know, it's interesting because she was facing a different set of challenges than a lot of the women in the field would face today. You know, we are in a time period, the last several years or so, where we've seen a large increase in the number of women on active deployment, combat missions, and so forth. She was working as a support staff and, you know, kind of at a time, ironically, when a lot of the men were gone. So there was actually a little bit more of an open-mindedness at that particular time because they knew that they could rely on these women that had these administrative skills and secretarial skills. They'd been trained to do these jobs, and they were brought in, and it's kind of revolutionary that they allowed them to actively enlist at the time. And over time, you can kind of see this legacy of service that, you know, the Marines have this association of toughness and so forth, and now you've got places like ABC News and so forth who are profiling women on active duty and leading training deployments in the Marine, and it really is Johnson's legacy that, you know, she kind of broke that first barrier and taking jobs serving her fellow female Marines, and now we've got female Marines leading men and women in the field.
And so why would you say it's important for people to know about her, and how does she relate to today?
Well, you know, the Women's Marine Association in particular, you know, they really feel that connection. They really feel her legacy. She was actually buried in an unmarked grave in Rock Creek Cemetery in D.C. when she died in 1955. You know, and it wasn't intentional. It was just that was one of those things at the time that they had very small markers or so forth, or that there were lists of where the people were plotted if you didn't have a giant marker and so forth. But the Women's Marine Association last year ran a fundraiser to install an official marker and small monument. And they actually successfully funded it, and that site was unveiled on August 29th of this year. In fact, the current Commandant of the Marine Corps, who's General Robert Beller, spoke at the enshrinement of this new monument because they really appreciate that, you know, she's the first, and they're really trying to respect and honor this legacy that she started.
Can anybody go and see the monument?
Yeah, it is open to the public. The cemetery is open for visitors, and in fact, on the Marine Women Association Facebook page, they posted video and photos of the ceremony. So if you look at the Women's Marine Association on Facebook and look at fundraisers and so forth, you can find pictures of the event and the video of General Neller speaking and so forth.
What was it like for you writing the article? How did you do your research and get your information?
Oh, it was, you know, it was fun. One of the things that we do at the Saturday Evening Post, one of the taglines that we've always had is celebrating America, past, present, future. And so we try to pay particular attention to running down dates that might have been historically significant. I was looking at things, writing about for that month, and I ran across this mention of Johnson, and I dug into it a little more, and I pitched it. And one of the things that I did was look up primary newspaper accounts like the Richmond one I mentioned earlier and to see if there were books and so forth that mentioned Johnson. And I'm always attracted to the idea of firsts. You know, it's always interesting, especially in the context of, you know, talking about American history. Firsts are a big deal for us as a country. And it did tie in really nicely with the fact that, like I mentioned before, that we have been seeing this increase in the amount of coverage, women succeeding in command positions in the military. You have to kind of appreciate how long that's actually been going on and all the groundwork that had to be laid for those things to happen. You know, I'd like to point out that since Johnson enlisted, we've had thousands and thousands of women that have served in the armed forces, both in combat and support. And as of 2015, which is the last year I had strong numbers for, about 2 million women in the United States are veterans. And I think that it's definitely important that we recognize those women. And as of May of this year, 92 women actually serve in combat positions in the Marine Corps. So that's only 7% of the Marine Corps as a whole in terms of active combat. But the idea when Johnson enlisted that there would be women serving in active combat as Marines was kind of as distant as putting someone on the moon. So the fact that she helped lay the groundwork for that, I think, is very important. It's important that we recognize what those women are doing today.
That's Troy Brownfield, the staff writer for the Saturday Evening Post, speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about the first woman Marine being a native Hoosier. With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Peter Iglinskas, who's been organizing film noir nights at the Brower Museum of Art for quite some time. Peter, how long have you been doing this?
John, we've been doing this for four seasons. This will be our fifth season.
Okay, good. Well, that's a nice track record.
It is. It is.
And as many of these films are quite obscure, at least by title, but they sometimes have big stars in them.
That's correct. And I do try to steer clear of the ones that get a lot of airtime on, mm-hmm. on television and
like
on cable.
Stranger on a Train or...
Yeah, that gets aired a lot.
It does.
And so I kind of dig deeper into the film noir canon to give the audience a chance to experience some of these films that they wouldn't otherwise ever see.
They're fascascinating movies, and I just like the atmosphere of them so much.
Oh, they're so atmospheric, and they're true works of art. That was such a marvelous period of Hollywood filmmaking.
So, is there a specific time period in which the bulk of them were made?
Yes, pretty much from 1940, let's say, Stranger on the Third Floor, mm-hmm. To some people take it to about 1959, Odds Against Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Some people stop at around 58 with Touch of Evil. Mm-hmm. So some of those boundaries can be a little squishy, but pretty much those 20 mm-hmm. years, the 40s and the 50s.
I've been watching on Sunday nights. I don't have cable television. I've never had any kind of service like that, too cheap. So I just have an antenna stuck up on my roof, and I've been so channel 32.2,
okay.
The movie channel, it's
yes.
called, and they have a film noir feature on
Sunday
evenings.
Night Noir. Absolutely.
So has that been going on a long time?
That I think they've had that a few years, mm-hmm. but and there's also the Noir Alley on TCM. Hosted by Eddie Muller, who was the chairman of the, founder of the Film Noir Foundation.
So what is your season this year?
So
starting right away.
Yeah, actually we start this week, January 17th, mm-hmm. and we have our event every the third Thursday of every month,
okay.
January through April. The events start at 7 o'clock. We screen the film, and then after a short break, we reconvene, and we have a lecture discussion that I present mm-hmm. with projected still images to enhance the presentation. This season, January 17th, we're showing Detour from mm-hmm. 1945. It's a gem directed by Edgar G. Ulmer, with a screenplay by Martin Goldsmith based on his hard-boiled novel of the same title. And mm-hmm. it is by many considered the perfect film noir.
Ah.
Short, sweet, and gets right to the point and features perhaps the most savage femme fatale in film noir.
Who is
named Anne Savage.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding.
Huh, that's
the actress is Anne Savage.
That's yes. funny.
And February 21st, we're doing...
Is she the mother of Dan Savage by any chance?
Doubt it, but I might not have that.
Never mind. Go on.
February 21st, we're screening The Window, 1949, based on the novelette by Conrad Woolrich, The Boy Who Cried Murder. It's mm-hmm. basically a noir retelling of Aesop's fable of The Boy Who Cried Wolf. March 21st is Kansas City Confidential from 1952, a great caper film. I always try to put a caper film in the lineup. Heist films are all part of the film noir mystique. And April 18th, we are screening Nightfall from 1957. It's a classic wrong place, wrong time story that has an amazing pedigree, directed by Jacques Tourneau, screenplay by Sterling Siliphant, and stars a wonderfully lithe, sexy young Anne Bancroft.
Oh, wow.
As a fashion model who gets caught in the middle of all of these shenanigans in
cool.
that film. Yeah.
So these take place in one of the galleries at the Brouwer Museum.
Right, in the main gallery. And mm-hmm. so you're watching these films as works of art amidst the works of art mm-hmm. hanging on the wall. Mm-hmm. The events are free. The museum also provides free popcorn and bottled water. So you can't beat that for a date night.
No. So the response you get that you've been getting all these years is good? It's growing?
Yes, it's been quite wonderful. I can't say it's standing room only because whenever we fill up the chairs, the director of the museum, Greg Hertzley, brings out more chairs. And I have to thank you for coming to our last event last season.
What was that movie called? I love the way that it ended on the freeway, that was under construction.
Right. That was The Lineup from 1958, starring Eli Wallach. So it was great to see you come in. You brought a whole entourage.
I had a posse, yes.
A posse. A posse comitatus. Yeah.
I go in pack. I travel in packs.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you showing up.
Well, Peter, thank you for coming to tell us about this season's lineup of film noir movies that you're presenting at the Brouwer Museum. And first one, This Thursday night. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
More Eye on the Arts next Monday here on Regionally Speaking. You can hear this conversation and previous Eye on the Arts conversations online right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.